Welcome back to Beyond Well. I'm Sheila Hamilton, and this is a program for people who want to learn more about our interior lives. And we have been so grateful to Dr. Stephen Whiteside from the Mayo Clinic, who has been talking with us about the anxiety-ridden child. And within the category of anxiety lies all these other behaviors that you might be concerned about when your child starts demonstrating them. Among the one that I hear the most from parents is, I had this outgoing, incredibly happy child, and suddenly they have become so withdrawn. Help. So Dr. Stephen Whiteside is here to join us. And by the way, you can get his book called The Anxiety Coach on Amazon. I am highly recommending it for parents of kiddos up to the age of 18. Dr. Whiteside, good to see you. So talk to me just a little bit. I remember my daughter going through a period where I was like, I don't recognize this kid. She's so shy. Is that normal?
Well, you know, I think change is probably the one thing that's normal for our childhood, and especially around teenage years and adolescence. And so that is pretty typical for kids to kind of go through periods where things are significantly different than they were before, or they will be afterwards. But that doesn't mean that we want to overlook things and not respond when our child is struggling with something.
Is it a struggle to go through a shy period, or is it just their way of trying on different personality types and trying to understand who they want to be in the world?
Yeah, I think that the transition to middle school, high school, and just gradually as kids are growing up, they're very naturally becoming much more centered on their friends and starting to think more about kind of what their friends think of them, what other kids think of them, rather than making their parents happy. And especially as they start to get older and start to have romantic interests, then there's much more, you know, nervousness about whether or not they'll be accepted or attractive. And so it's perfectly normal to go through a shy period where all of a sudden it sort of hits you, kind of all these different fears and worries, and you kind of withdraw a little bit and a little bit more nervous with social interactions when you weren't before.
When do you need to become concerned about the level of withdrawal, Dr. Whiteside?
Two things. One would be kind of the amount of distress, and two, whether or not it's causing problems. I guess I would add a third one, also duration. We can all go through pretty upsetting problems that get in the way of life, but if they are short-lived and they pass and we go back to our normal functioning, then it's not something that we need to seek help with. So if kids are really distressed, they're upset by it, they're wanting to continue to be outgoing, or they're wanting to do the things that they used to do, or the things that their peers are doing, but they just feel like they can't, then that would be a sign to be concerned. And also if they're not doing things that are expected, so if they're withdrawing and they're not going to activities they used to, or they're you know, kind of quitting the basketball team or dance or other clubs or activities, they're not doing things on the weekends with their friends, they're not interacting as much, or withdrawing from schoolwork and things like that, that would be another time to be concerned.
You know, I think one of the most common conversations I have with parents of kids who are afraid their kids are going through a mental health crisis is that the child refuses to see a practitioner, that they not only won't acknowledge that they're suffering, but that they refuse to get help. That must be a really common theme in your practice, where a parent has dragged a kid there who didn't think they wanted to come in, especially teenagers.
Yes, I would say it's extremely rare that kids or teenagers are the ones who want to come in, suggest coming in, or particularly want to talk about it. You know, especially teens, they want to be independent. They want to be able to handle things themselves. They don't want to be different in anything where they have to be asking somebody else, especially an adult, for help. And it's something that they perceive that other kids and teens are not doing. They're going to be naturally resistant to that.
What kind of conversation can you have with the child to reduce the stigma and also really let them know that you're on their side in trying to figure out what they're going through?
Probably a number of different ways to approach it. I guess I approach it sort of in a business-like way. What is the difficulty that brings them in, and what can we do to help them? And so part of that is listening to them and making it clear from the beginning that they're the expert on their lives and how they feel. And it's really important what their parents think, because it's their parents that brought them in here. But just because their parents think one thing doesn't mean it's right, that they both have valid opinions and we want to hear both of them. And also, even if they both agree that, yes, being nervous and worried is a problem, they may have different reasons for why they think it's important to work on that. You know, parents may want them to be, you know, participating more in class, and it may be important to kids that they feel more comfortable at after school activities. So focusing on the problems the way the child sees it and making sure that we work on that. And then the other piece is just making clear that it's normal, that this is what I do all day, every day, is talk to kids and teens in exactly this situation. So there's nothing particularly unusual about it. And as you know, we work in groups. So kind of the next step is we're going to go to a group with a bunch of other kids doing the same thing.
A lot of friends whose kids had their worst year of struggle in the year between 17 and 18, and then they refuse help during that critical year, and then they turn 18, and the parent can no longer force them to do anything. And it's at that point that they're living in the house, maybe not pursuing any of the college dreams, not helping with chores. And the condition around what it is that the state will do to have you actually take control, it varies from state to state. But in many states, even if a kid is suicidal, you can't do anything about it because unless they actively have a plan, especially in Oregon, you can't bring them in without their will and their consent. So, how do you manage that when you know, based on your kids' previous behaviors, that they may be to the level of suffering that they're thinking about suicide?
Just the idea that our kids are hurting enough that they don't want to be alive is painful enough. But then the prospect of losing our kids to suicide is terrifying for all parents. The level or the criteria for having someone hospitalized against their will is really high. And it can be done. So that's important to keep in mind. If the mental health system is set up, especially a hospitalization, to make sure people are safe in the moment. And so if a child or if anyone is, deemed by a health professional to be a risk to hurt themselves or others, they can be hospitalized even if they don't consent. In those extreme situations, when this really is kind of what we're looking at, the system can help.
Yeah, I've been in a situation with three different people who are suicidal, and what they inevitably do is tell the people around them they're going to kill themselves. And then when the authorities show up, they deny that they have a suicide plan. It's very difficult to actually prove that a person has said they're going to kill themselves. And so I find this conundrum again and again and again, especially with this really critical age. Give a playbook to some of our parents who are coping with this situation right now, with kids who have totally withdrawn from school, from life, and are just spending their time in their basements on their phone.
Yeah. So there's probably two pieces of it. One is what to do in the immediate crisis where you are concerned enough that your child is suicidal so that you've called the authorities or you've gotten them to the emergency department. But once you're there, they're denying that they're suicidal so that the treatment team throws their hands up or, sends them home because they don't feel like there's enough to hold them. So in that situation, your most important goal is to keep your child safe. And so that will involve making sure there is nothing lethal at home, with guns being number one, because with many suicide attempts, once you've done it, you can decide that was a really bad idea and you can go seek help because once it's happened, you realize you shouldn't have done that. With guns, you don't have that option. They're the most lethal form of suicide. So making sure that kids don't have access to guns would be number one. And then number two, other sharp objects, medications for overdose, make sure that we've tried to make the environment as safe as possible. And then the second piece is supervision and monitoring. So if you're concerned that your child is acutely suicidal and you can't get help for them, making sure that you are with them so that they are safe.
Yeah. Especially with that child who has just turned 18, is it within the realm of an agreement that you say, well, if you're going to stay here, you need to get help? Can you be firm with a person who may be possibly considering suicide, say, you need to get up, you need to help do the chores. If you're not going to school, then I need you to look for a job. Like, I'm always trying to understand, is there a firm line you can take with people with mental health disorders?
Yeah, so then that leads into what do you do more generally to try to help your child get functioning and start building independence? And so, yes, you need to be firm and you need to have expectations, you need to enforce them, but you also need to only kind of make deals or set out contingencies that you're willing to either you get a job or you're out. Probably many parents would not do that because in the end, you decide, and perhaps and very likely rightly, that my child is better off at home in the basement than being kicked out of the house because
That's right.
it's really unlikely that getting kicked out of the house is going to get them to turn around and all of a sudden do things that they weren't doing. So instead, it's hard enough to have limits and rewards and consequences with an 8-year-old, much less with an 18-year-old. But the same principles apply, is that here are the things that we are providing to you. And for those things, here's what we need you to do. And starting small with chores around the house or participating in family meals or cleaning up or cooking or, going for a walk or volunteering or looking into online schooling and figuring out where could you take an online class as a first step. And having those requirements and then deciding what with an 18-year-old, what is reasonable to withhold.
I love that warning about be careful of the limits you place, because I know so many people that take away their kids' phones and then the kid spirals even further because that's been their one connection to the outside world and they give it right back. So it's.
And when you take, so like in that situation, then it sounds like the parents feel able to take the child's phone away. And the way you set that up for success is by making the expectation to get it back very small. Taking your phone away until you clean up your room. And then you can phone back immediately. Not, I am fed up with this, you're losing the phone back when I'm not fed up with you anymore, because that's not going to go anywhere. Clear, this is what you have to do to get it back. You can get it back immediately if you do it, but if you take a while, then it's going to be gone for a while. It will be, likely painful because they're 18 and they don't want to be treated like a little kid, and they'll get very upset. And obviously, they're having trouble getting themselves to do these small tasks, or else they would have done it on their own. But if parents can stay strong and they've set an appropriately small goal, then the child or young adult follows through with that, and then we've set ourselves up to have a larger expectation the next time.
It just occurs to me, Dr. Whiteside, that there is a normal progression at some point in a child's life where they are going to try on different personalities. With my daughter, it was shy. With some kids, it's with risk-taking. With other kids, sexual behavior. And that from what you're saying, we need to adopt a real sense of patience and grace for them while they transition through these periods. But how long is too long to let a kid experiment with a personality change that doesn't really suit them?
It's partly helpful to think if you decide that now is too long, what are you going to do? So it also depends on what they're experimenting with. Like if your child is hanging out with some kids that you don't particularly approve of, and you tell them you're not hanging out with those kids anymore, then they probably are going to hang out with those kids even more. So not to dissuade someone from having a conversation about, here are my concerns, can we talk about it? And I think maybe you shouldn't do this, but forbidding your child to dye their hair or do things like that is probably going to result in, especially in the teenage years, when they don't want to be told what to do, just they're having added emphasis that I want to do that more. If it's not harming themselves and it's not harming anyone else, it's probably best to let them do that.
I always had this rule for myself, especially in the years I was a single mom, was the question I always asked when I would start to get upset about what I would see her wear or what I would see her doing is this the sword I want to fall on for this particular argument? And if it was about what she was wearing, or if it was about like things that were superficial, I really tried to prompt myself to save that sword for a much more important conversation, you know?
No, that's a great way to think about it. And my daughter's 11, so I may be singing a different tune 5 years from now.
Really, it's going to be two that they grow up so fast now. It's really remarkable. I'm just finishing this incredible documentary on a man who started these outdoor camps for teenagers. His name was Steve Cardozano, and I was a young reporter in Utah when we covered these camps, and they were talking about the tens of thousands of families who send their kids away every single year to these outdoor camps because they can no longer control them. And I'm thinking, I remember covering this story back then, and horrible things were happening. Is there anywhere you can actually send a kid who has withdrawn, who is no longer going to school, who may be doing drugs or alcohol, that's actually safe?
So one kind of answer to that is there's not enough child mental health options available. Another answer is that there are residential programs that are reputable and safe for kids. Another part of that is it depends what the child is struggling with. So if a child is struggling with substance abuse, or if a child is struggling with rule breaking behavior, conduct issues, those treatment options are different than for kids who are withdrawn and are very depressed or are dealing with significant anxiety.
What happens in your practice where you're at the point when you're working with someone where you say, I am over my skis with this kid. He needs to go in patient for a longer term, more acute type setting? When does that occur?
The vast majority of what I do is working with kids who have anxiety and OCD. We do find ourselves in that situation because we have a 5-day intensive treatment program that's designed for people who are dealing with kids who's withdrawal, maybe because they're anxious or have OCD, anxiety disorder problems. And so they can come and stay here in Rochester, Minnesota, and work through our 5-day intensive treatment program with the idea that they will feel less anxious and more brave by the end of it. Parents are involved the whole time, and they have skills that they can use to continue to work on this when they go home. That program really is a replacement for standard outpatient treatment because we know most kids can't find exposure therapy closer to home. So we're not a replacement for residential. So one of the decisions we have to help families make is this an appropriate step? I mean, do we have a reasonable chance of being successful given the severity of your child's anxiety? And if we feel like, wow, this is clearly much more significant than we're able to make a dent in 5 days, then we refer them to a handful of residential programs that we use regularly.
What specifically would you have to be witnessing to make that determination?
One way that we answer the question is rather than kind of what's been going on, how confident does the family feel that they are able to do what we're going to do? Our intensive program is we meet in a group setting with typically around 6 kids and one or two of their parents. It's like a classroom setting. So we talk and report in what we've done, and then we separate and everyone work with the parents to face their fears. And then we come back and talk about it again, and they do it again on their own over lunch. And then we have an afternoon activity, et cetera. And if we describe that to a family, they're like, oh my gosh, I can't even get my child out of bed. There's no way that we could do that day in and day out for 5 days. Then we say, well, then yes, we probably need to do another setting. Or if just asking their child to do something leads to a huge emotional blow up, fight, and child storms out or is harming themselves, then we know that we're not going to be able to ask them to do stressful things while they're here. If they're going to fight with their parents, they probably need a higher level of care.
Can you put percentages on what kind of ranking most kids are in? Are most kids able to be helped in this outpatient setting? Or do you have an awful lot of those referrals over to a more serious inpatient setting?
It's a hard question to answer because there are kind of a number of gates with how people get in. But you know, so our program is pretty specific for kids with anxiety and OCD. So kids with other problems who are struggling with anger or self-harm or substance use aren't considered for the program because that's not what we work on. But for the ones that do seem to be suffering from OCD and anxiety, the vast majority of them are appropriate to come to our program. Partly because even if we think, you know what, this seems pretty severe, but the family says we could give that a try, the options are not come to us or go straight to a residential program. The options are come to us or get on a waiting list for a number of months before you go to a residential program.
Right.
So many of those families decide and come work with us.
Oh, interesting. Wow. I love talking with you, Dr. Whiteside. Because more of my friends with school age kids are now tuning in because you're on, I'm hearing about just a whole new plethora of challenges they have, including their safety online. And I hope we can talk about that. Dr. Stephen Whiteside, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sheila.